Okay, so next week is the final lecture week, right? And we have the pipe thing due on Friday.
Fine.
Probably better. I'd sort of like it to be closed in business on Friday, so 5. But I know that that won't work no matter what I claim, so let's just call it midnight on Friday. You're going to grade it online.
I mean,
I hope. What?
Does that mean?
By Eastern time.
No, but you say midnight on Friday, that's Thursday night.
Okay, you got me there.
11:59
Friday evening, right? So sometime before Saturday. Is that better? This is like people don't know when the millennium starts, right? including me. Thank you. Good one. He said, taking the arrow out of his chest. Before Saturday. Local time. Well, I have been wondering what time zone you're in. You started it. Okay, so we have one more session. You can see I'm already getting into the spirit of break. Right? We have the pipe thing due on Friday, and null stream, zero stream thing, frankly, was a spin-up exercise, and it served its purpose. And we sort of need to do one more piece to have enough. And what happened here is that null stream and zero stream were stalled long enough for various reasons that we're sort of forced to do the last as a final project rather than as an assignment. I had sort of hoped not to tie up final exam period at all. So that you know what's coming, there's going to be a third project part. And I'm gonna continue ratcheting up a little bit, but the idea was that null stream should be easy enough that you'd get to focus on the interface stuff, and then zero stream you'd move a little data here and there. And by the time you get to the pipe, you sort of know at least in abstract how to build the interface stuff. You'd have to dig into the IDL a little bit, but you'd mainly be dealing with the producer consumer issues and sort of trying to add something else at each step, but hopefully in manageable pieces. And I'm gonna look for another one that has that property as well. I'm gonna try to get the description for that sent out by end of tomorrow. That does not mean, looking ahead does not hurt, but it does not mean that I expect you to start it before the pipe exercise is done. It means I want you to have the option to plan, because at least one of you will. And I also want an opportunity to get feedback on the last day of class if it's totally over the top so that we can fix it. Because I don't want to get caught during the reading period with people looking at the thing for the first time and suddenly discovering that it's too much. So I certainly don't ask you to start it Thursday, but I do ask you to at least give it a look and see if you think it's sane or see if you can identify problems with it. I'm doing that for you, not for me. There will not be a final exam, so that's the good news. So that's where I'm planning to go. I want you to know what's coming and why, and I do want your feedback on it if you think that's appropriate. And I'm probably looking for sort of about the same level of ratchet. We had a ratchet between zero stream and pipe. I'm going to look for about that much again. I'm not trying to go over the top here. We are obviously not going to do a serial driver. That's okay. That's what's coming, and we'll declare victory on that. I apologize for the earned F behavior note. I overreacted to something. The way I reacted was inappropriate. I said that in the email that I sent out earlier today. In a perfect world, it would not be the way I would have gotten the result, but the way that all of you have responded to that note has been positive, even if it's an unfortunate start of recently. So I apologize for doing that. In my comments at the end of that email about being visibly stuck, I wasn't trying to point the finger at anybody. Just anytime you're in a class, you're going to have an assignment. Something will get you stuck, and it's good if the people on the grading side can see that you're working on it, because then they have a chance to work with you, and you have to give them that chance, or they can't work with you in any class you take. for that matter, it's true in any relationship where you're supposed to have something done. You know, there's commitment, there may be anger, right? So the other side needs to see that there's been good faith. Okay, so questions about that, or about final exam, or about anything along those lines? Well, until I've made it up, it's hard to estimate what's appropriate, and I don't want to give an inappropriate answer. But I'm not trying to go over the top. I don't know how to answer your question better than that. No, not yet. And we do have some bounds, right? We're not going to go past the exam period, except for you. There are two sides to that sword. Okay. Other questions about that? Any sort of clarification questions about the pipe assignment?
When we're using malloc, I found that there's this kerning malloc.
Oh no, kerning malloc is absolutely not what you want.
Absolutely
not what you want. I mean, kerning is private internal header files to the kernel.
Okay, but then there was another. The kerning one referenced another one that it said was the private one. So it just.
It's in kerning. It's none of your business.
Okay.
For purposes of writing application level code, I would almost say the sys tree should not exist.
Gotcha.
It's not quite true because sys kyotos is the public headers of the kernel, and sys IDL obviously publishes interfaces that happen to live down there.
It's just confusing because there's also a
test malloc. A test malloc is testing the malloc library routine. So look, the real answer to your question is there is a malloc in libc. That's the one you want, and what you want to include is malloc data. As long as you're not using a small space, you won't run into any rude surprises doing that. Yes, you should. Other questions about the pipe design?
What exactly is the pipe?
The memory address space of the pipe object.
So does it support the client?
Sorry?
Does it reside at both clients?
I don't know what that means. Because there's a sender, there's a receiver, and there's the pipe object. And the sender and the receiver certainly should not have that in their address space at all. Let's turn it around. Imagine that we were talking about the Unix kernel implemented pipe. If there's a buffer, if I'm the writer, I only have access to the buffer in the sense that I can perform a write call on the kernel and make a copy into it. If I'm the reader, I only have access in the sense that I can make a read call on the kernel and make a copy out. The buffer is private to the pipe implementation. That's exactly how it should be here. Can I answer your question? The difference is here it's not going to be in the kernel. And In a hypothetical better world where we had an application debugger that was working, we might even be able to debug it. And as you all know, debugging things in the kernel is a lot of fun. Enough of that. But that doesn't change the logic of who's in control of the buffer. And back to this thing about how many objects are there, right? This is part of why that sharing of state is a confusing point. What's really going on is, right. Well, there's a sense in which there's an input stream object, and there's a sense in which there's an output stream object, and there's actually a sense in which there's a pipe object, which is perhaps a control interface on this whole assembly. But when you dig into the procedures, the methods that are sitting inside the pipe application, the behavior from one interface, the behavior from the second interface, the behavior from the third interface, they're all being implemented by the same piece of code, running in the same address space. So when you say, is the buffer owned by the input side or the output side, the answer is yes. Because there is, from an implementation perspective, there's only one side. What's that?
You mean to say the address space?
I mean, with this pipe, I mean the process that's implementing all of this behavior. It's in that address space. I'm not sure I've resolved the confusion, but have I answered the question? No questions about that. So, you've written a little bit of application code and the objects that we've chosen, there's that slippery word again, have been, you know, deliberately chosen as learning exercises. Ironically, I sent a note off to one of our clients today saying, you know, if I'd been using my brain, I would have had them do the assignment too, right? Because they need to learn this stuff too, and we need to develop a sort of a tutorial sequence, right? And these two things that we looked at, the one that you did and the one that you're doing now, are actually reasonable early ones in the tutorial. Except, of course, come Friday at midnight. No, I guess that would be Saturday at midnight. There's going to be an official one that's going to get published, right? right? Or, well, official really means I will have written it, right? It doesn't mean it's any better than yours. In fact, it may be worse. And mine will cheat, by the way. But the production version will not attempt to deal with the case where some dingbat calls setBuffer with a value that's irrationally small. The reason I'm asking you to look at that is I want you to understand why allowing it is a really bad idea. It can be done. Like, it's just, it's an unnecessary, complicating pain in the ass. And sometimes the right answer is, if it hurts when you do that, don't do that. I want to dig into a couple of the sort of production base system processes, so you see how they're going to go. And one of the ones that's a little interesting is the constructor. Like the pipe, it has two interfaces, which, by the way, is another slippery word. And I believe, I'm not 100% sure whether this is true in our version, that one of those interfaces actually is just, it's not enabled until the second interface is done. So here's the idea. Ignoring what happens in an MKI file, what happens at runtime? When I have a constructor, I want to build a new program. What I do is I go allocate a new constructor. What I get back is an entry capability to this new constructor, which is, it's a virgin constructor, right? It's got nothing in it. I start populating it, right? I put in a capability that's going to be its address space. I put in capabilities that are going to be its tools. I put in some other capabilities. I say what its program counter should be when it starts. And at some point, I say, OK, I'm done. Seal the constructor. After the seal operation, I cannot add new capabilities. And after the seal operation, I get back what's called a requester's capability. A requester's capability allows me to say to the constructor, whatever it is that you build, please build one of those. And it also lets me ask the constructor, whatever it is that you build, if I were to ask you to build one of those, hypothetically, would it come into the world adding capabilities that allow it to write to somebody else? The idea here is, I have a program I'm creating, right? Here's me, or of course me in this context is some process that's asking this question. And I want to create a new yield or a new instance of the yield of the constructor. And what I want to know is there a boundary around this yield, right, so that the only way out is to talk to me at the time that the instance gets created. And then give it other ways to talk. But I want to know that if it's going to get another way to talk, I had to give it another way to talk. The other way to say that is, I want to know that if this thing tries to send a message that way, it's not going to get anywhere. Maybe I'm sorting some piece of data that I don't want to have you get. So let's look at how the constructor does that.
At this point, you'll know about that disgusting code, okay? And it has two booleans, whether it's sealed and whether it's confined. If it is not sealed, it is not known to be confined. And until we're done installing capabilities, we can't determine. There could always be one more, and that will be the one that means that this surrounding box doesn't exist. Okay, so here's a procedure.
It's misnamed, by the way. It should be discrete, not cap. It should be cap as discrete, not cap as confined. So what does it mean, discrete? It means there's no operation I can perform on this capability that would give me write access to anything. So a read-only page capability is discrete. A read-only GPT capability is not discrete. Can anybody tell me why?
Give it a shot? Yeah, I define things unclearly or inexactly.
It's not just that the object I'm talking to is not modifiable. It's that there's no way, starting from that object, that I can get any object that's modified.
If I had a read-only GPT, what could I do that conceivably could get me a read-write capability?
A read-write capability, some other read-write capability, not necessarily one of that GPT. I have a const pointer to a structure. Is that a transitive restriction, or is that a one-step restriction? One-step restriction. struct in turn contains a non-const pointer as a member field. I can reach in, I can fetch out the non-const pointer, and then I can write to whatever it points to. I don't even have to play games with cats. That's legal. So in the same way, a read-only GPT capability, I could fetch a capability out of one of the slots, right? And if that capability in that slot happens to be read-write, I've now got a read-write capability. And if I have a read-write capability, I have a way to send information. If I have a way to send information, I am not discrete. What about a null capability? Is a null capability discrete? I transmit information by invoking a null capability? I don't think so. Good. Here's some caution. In nasty ways, you're getting the better of you. Well, the answer is yes, of course I can. First, I can transmit information to me, right? The null capability is going to always respond, does not understand, another request. But that's okay, right? We're concerned about information to somebody else. There's a sleazy answer that's actually yes, which is, well, if I already hold a capability to you, I can invoke the null capability, and I can say to the null capability, send your response to him. But notice that there's no new authority here, because I already held the authority to talk to him. If I didn't hold it, I couldn't have passed it to the null capability. The answer is, a null capability is discrete. It's considered discrete. What we're going to do here, as the confinement check, we're going to say, well, let me just go through all of the capabilities that were installed in the constructor. If all of the capabilities individually are discrete, if all the capabilities are discrete, then the yield is going to have to be confined. Why? Because the yield consists of a set of discrete capabilities. We know they're not a problem because we checked. A newly fabricated process that nobody else holds any access to. And some newly allocated storage that nobody else holds any access to that was allocated from the space bank. So the contract here derives from, on the one hand, some of the capabilities, most of the capabilities provide no write authority. And on the second, those that do are exclusively held. If I'm the only party that can talk to them, then there must be no channel to you yet. Now, I can start in this safe state, and I can have two of these boxes. Maybe there's something else built before, okay? And I could send a message containing a capability to this thing that I built before. Once I send that message, there's a path. That does not violate confinement. The requirement for confinement is not that there be no channels. The requirement of confinement is that all the requirement for confinement is that all of the channels must be authorized. By sending the capability, I am authorized. In addition, we're trying to guarantee is that I get the chance to make authorization decisions. We're going to do that by establishing this initial safe state and then deciding what authorizations to do. Contrast this with Unix, where if I start a process, it only starts off with a few relatively innocuous permissions, like the rights to mess with any of my files, the rights to talk to my terminal, and the right to open network connections, short anything I can do. Time principle. You don't build robust systems by starting with too much and deciding to take one away. You build robust systems by starting with nothing and deciding what to grant. So, there are two kinds of discrete capabilities, right? There are some that are discrete simply because of the kind of capability it is. A null capability is intrinsically discrete, and the kernel knows that. Second possibility is, and this is by special dispensation, if the capability is a requester's capability, some other constructor, and the other constructor is discrete, and we consider it to be discrete. By the way, there's a bug here, and I'll come back to that. Let me explain to me why that's okay. Because if I recall that requester's capability, right, the constructor has state. It's going to modify that state. You're going to call that constructor. Right? It's going to go and access that state, and that's a communication path. Why do we allow that to be considered discrete? Why is that okay? Okay, because we know what code that constructor runs. Constructor is a case of a trusted program manipulating potentially unsafe data. We know it's okay to do this. First, we know it's okay to do the discretion check, and second, we know it's okay to invoke the request for escapability, assuming the discretion check passes, because we know what the constructor does. And we know that if it tells us it's discrete, and it really is a constructor, that we can rely on that because we know what code it runs.
Now, there is a bit of a problem. Okay.
The fact that it's a constructor is not good enough, right? So this says, okay, if it's not intrinsically discrete and it's not a constructor, we're done. It's presumptively a source of leaks. Now we're dealing with the constructor case, right? And there are two kinds of those. There's a constructor verifier capability that's okay. And there is a constructor builders. Okay, builders can leak. And then the remaining case is that it's a requester's capability. We're going to do this. Okay. By the ISBE check. So ISBE gets set. Well, maybe I should explain. So identify an entry that's given an entry capability, right, and this brand thing, if and only if I already know the brand of the thing that the entry points to, this will tell me, one, yes, it points to that thing. Two, whether the thing it points to is in fact myself. Three, what's the protected payload on the entry capability? Now, at some point, I'm going to go, I know now it's a constructor, I'm going to go and say, well, I'm going to ask the constructor, is the thing that you build confined? That's the last test. Why do I want to avoid that if that constructor is in fact myself? Why do I not want to call it if it is me? The time that I perform the call, what state am I in? Receiving? Am I receiving?
Can you pull the...
If I am executing instructions, am I receiving? What are the states of a process in Kubernetes? Executing instructions, I'm running. Running and receiving are disjoint states. So if I am calling, I'm executing instructions. If I'm executing instructions, I'm not receiving. What happens when you call a process that is not receiving? Why? Might be a good reason not to call yourself.
So constructor is confined is also misnamed, right? This should be yield is confined. What are we going to do? Well, if the address space is confined, right? And we actually don't need to check protospace. Oh, in this system, we may actually be able to change protospace. And if that's the case, we need to be able to check it. If the fault handler is confined, right? Why does that matter? Well, the process, if it takes a fault, it's going to communicate with the fault handler. If the fault handler can communicate to a third party, we've lost our box. And then for each slot in the tools page, the capability in that slot is confined. If all those things are confined, we're good. What about the tools page itself? The tools page itself is not a problem because we're not going to give the process a read-write capability to it. So it's read-only, right? But remember, there was this problem with GPT. I could fetch a read-write capability out of it. Well, I could do that with a capability page as well. In this case, it's okay because we know that each of the items in the capability page is discrete. But so much for the testing aspect of it. ZIF, you've dealt with, all right, that type. Right, so is yield confined? So here's what happens. At the moment that you seal the constructor, we just run this test once, and then we cache the result in these booleans. So the two interesting operations here, or the three interesting operations, are the create operation that creates a new yield, the seal operation, which is where we run the confinement check, and then the others are just insert capability one at a time. Right? They're not really exciting. Except that, well, I'll come back to that. Okay, so let me come back to the create operation. Right. So set handler, set space, set PC, right? These are all things that are just setting slots. Okay. Set tool is also setting slots. And then there's the seal operation, right? The seal operation, here's what it does. It says, okay, I am going to erase. So until we're sealed, we have to be able to update the tools page. After we're sealed, we must not update the tools page. And there's a little bit of paranoia here, which is basically ensure
we cannot update the tools page by dropping our own write authority. After this point, even if you manage to call the builder's capability, and even if the code screws up, it's not going to be able to edit the tools page.
Now, this is incomplete because you could still make some other mistakes, but it's a step in the right direction. And at that point, we say, okay, now we're sealed. Oh, we make the entry capability that's going to be the requester's capability. We're going to return that. We are now sealed, and we are confined exactly if all the capabilities that were installed are discrete. So we do the check now that we're sealed. And having done so, we return this OK rule, this OK result. Now, notice that where we put this entry capability that we just fabricated, we put it into retval. The return value from the seal operation is the requester's capability. You can't even get your paws on one unless the constructor is sealed. And since there's protocol in the requester's capability that relies on the fact that you're sealed, right, there's an interlock here. It's a safety interlock. Okay, let's just see if there's anything else. Okay, the initialization code is not enormously. Okay, initialization of this object is ever so slightly tricky. And one might wish that it were not. The reason is we have constructors that are fabricated in MKI files. Those never go through the builder phase of the protocol because they're built, you know, in this sleazy by-hand way inside the MKI file. We need a way to tell them, you know, when you start running, you've actually already been built. You need to pretend that the seal operation has happened and migrate immediately into the sealed state. There is a little bit of hair in the initialization. The way we do this is there's a register that we whack. If that register is non-null, which can only happen through the MKI mechanism, then the constructor says, oh, I'm coming up in the pre-built state and I should sort of do the right things to reflect that. One of the things you learn in building a system like Kyotis is there's always a few processes, like down at the bottom of the world, right? In Unix, init is one of these. And these processes are just icky. And they have to do a few sleazy maneuvers. Somewhere the induction of dependency has to stop. And at the bottom, there's always something icky. Well, this is one of the ickies. That's a technical term. Okay. Right. And you've done process requests until you're nauseous about them. We won't do that. Now let's look at create, because so the protocol for create, I've got a sealed constructor. Actually, it might not be sealed. I can do create before it's sealed, although how I get that capability is an interesting question. I have a constructor. I hand it some storage, right? This is the storage from which the new, I hand it a source of storage. The storage from which the new process is going to get allocated. And it's going to go and allocate a process and build it, kick it off. Of course, that assumes that the storage is authentic storage, right? The constructor has a contract. And the contract is two-way. There are actually two parts of the constructor contract. The one that gets touted in the papers on Eros is this confinement property. And that's a useful property, mostly because it sort of sets a bound on how far out of control things can go when they go wrong. We all know programs never go wrong, but the property that the constructor has is a certain kind of defensive encapsulation. Actually, the herd folks really don't like this property. But from the program perspective, right, I mean, one view here is, well, I'm concerned that the program may not be well-behaved, so I don't want to trust the program. The other side is, the program is concerned that I may not be so well-behaved, and so there may be things that it doesn't want to tell me. Unix, by virtue of being the creator of the program, that is sufficient to allow you to debug the program. Barring setuid. If it's a setuid program, you're not rude, you don't get to debug. Of course, the problem with this is, if I have any information in a program that I don't want you to get, A, I gotta make it setuid, B, I gotta have a reason to believe that you're not rude. I gotta ship it on encrypted media, and D, I gotta get the TBM mechanism to work, but let's not worry about the delivery pipeline. So, let me give a controversial example for some people, right? If I want to do digital rights management, what I need is the ability to build a program that can be on your machine and keep secrets from you. That's, in some sense, the defining property of a digital rights management system. You're not in control of the program. And, you know, if you really like movies, this is a feature, and if you really like liberty, this is a disaster. Back to that point.
course, if I'm a digital rights managing piece of software, I need to know that if I allocate storage, you provide it. That doesn't give you the right to sniff into my storage. I need to be able to put things in my heap that you won't get to see unless I agree. So I need to know that the exclusivity contract about storage is honored. And that's a contract that I have if I'm allocating storage from the space bank. I simply go to the space bank and say, are you a space bank? I know that it's a space bank. I know it claims to be a space bank. If I go to you and say, you're Fred, are you Fred? And you say, yes, what do I know? I know that you claim to be Fred. So I need to know that this thing is an official space bank, whatever that is. The answer is, well, it's an official space bank if the space bank verifier will tell me that it's a space bank. And the reason I can rely on the space bank verifier has to do with some of the low-level inductive construction in the system. Notice the builder does not put the verifier in there. That's part of the primordial tool set supplied by the constructor. If you don't have a robust constructor, it's because somebody fiddled the system at install time. That's something that can be checked, although we're not currently doing so. If I fiddle your Linux system, right, all of its answers are up for grabs. I can make it say anything I want. And that's true here too. Right? There's a bootstrapping of trust problem, which is sort of out of scope. And if you want to, then we'll talk about it next week. Anyway, that's why this check is here, is that the constructor actually implements two contracts. Now, let me for a minute digress on the politics of DRM for a minute. I'm certainly not going to get up here and stand here and suggest that the Recording Industry Association is your friend. 35,000 outstanding lawsuits and climbing would suggest that I'm a jackass if I say such a thing. They are, however, very good at suing 12-year-olds for things they don't understand. Enough said on RIAA. However, not all forms of DRM are bad. Password program implements a form of DRM. It uses encryption so that it is okay for Etsy password, or actually Etsy shadow, to be world readable. The only reason, in fact, historically, password information was in Etsy password, and it was as readable as every other part of Etsy password. The reason that stuff moved into Etsy shadow and ceased to be readable was that people realized that the original naive trapdoor encryption scheme implemented in Unix actually wasn't very good, and so that secret wasn't as secret as people thought it was. With the modern MD5 password scheme, there's absolutely no reason for Etsy shadow to be held private. Barring the hypothetical notion that somebody might scramble MD5, which is slowly going to happen, right?
Well, it wasn't able to pretty much inserting most common. If you could get a password, you won't be able to do it for a universe.
Okay, but that's a different threat model, right? I mean, I can implement that using getpass, right? The thing is, there's a whole subsystem that will run password checks for me. It will look at the password file on my behalf, but the end result is the same. The read-onlyness of Etsy shadow is at best a constant factor overhead against attack, because I can keep testing passwords.
Yes, but I can't do rainbow attacks. Password subsystem will
enable it. Okay, fair enough. I'm not actually proposing that Etsy shadow should be public. I think it's a good reason to keep it private just because people make stupidity errors. But let's think about the password program itself, and never mind the rainbow attack thing for a minute. There's a window of time where the SBIN password, or wherever it lives this week, right, holds my clear text password because I just typed it in. And what does it do with this clear text password? Well, it reapplies the encryption transform, and then it checks whether the result it gets this week is the same as the result it computed last week. That's basically how a one-way password checker works. So the problem is now it holds this data, namely my clear text password, that I would really prefer Nate not to know because Nate knows about rainbow text. Rainbows are much prettier than mine, but still. It's a great example of a program that should not operate using storage that I can inspect. Certainly not if you're running it and I control the storage, right? I mean, I like it if your passwords go to that program. If my passwords go to that program, I'm not so happy. It's DRM! It's not DRM protecting third-party data. There's some peculiar way in which my password is only, you know, it's mine, ignoring a couple of 13-year-olds in Eastern Europe. The mechanisms involved are identical. Here's the nasty observation.
the decision that you don't like DRM, that's a fine political decision to make. But from a technical perspective, there is absolutely no difference between the mechanism required for DRM and the mechanism required for privacy. It's perhaps unfortunate if you don't care for the current applications of DRM. And I don't. I don't know how to build systems that will protect my information without also building systems that will protect other people's information. Okay. I mean, conversely, right, I don't know how to build systems that will fail to protect my information without failing to protect other people's information. There are people who would say, hey, that's the right answer, because you know the sort of liberty of expression and the fact that expression becomes public is more important than whether my personal information can be protected. Valid political choice. Don't run Coyotes from Windows. It's really good at disclosing your information. Okay. There is something uncomfortable hiding in there, right? And this line of code right here, which verifies whether you've got a kosher space bank, is one of the primary reasons that the herd folks are not going to run Coyotes in unadulterated form. Not clear if they'll run it at all at this point, but this was the sticking point that started the debate. Okay. All right, well, so getting off of RIAA, it's really fun to beat those guys up, but you know, everybody does that. All right, what do we need? We're gonna try to run a new process, right? So first we need a process, so maybe we'll allocate one. Great, so we allocate this process, and oh boy, I don't like this code pattern. Jonathan Adams and I have gone back and forth whether we want to do these things as a sequence of double ands or as a sequence of knotted double ors. And it's purely a matter of convention which one is readable to you, and unfortunately I can't read this one. But, okay, I'll resurrect my old double E stuff and invert them in my head. So we need to allocate a process. Now, alloc process, there is an allocate operation you can do on a space bank that will just get you back a raw process. Okay. The difference is that there's no way to edit the yield slot of a process after it is fabricated. You can't change it. So as a convenience, since the space bank is ultimately the party who allocates processes, space bank implements this other allocate mechanism that gives you a shot at specifying the yield, the brand slot. I'm sorry, I said yield slot, I should have said brand slot. Why? The brand is the mechanism that's used later to confirm the identity of a process. If I know the brand in your process, and your process has the same brand, I can crack it open like that. So I'm going to allocate the process, I'm going to allocate two endpoints. Why two? One for you to speak on, and the other for you to listen on. Okay. Don't get them. We're not going to make it much further. And at that point, I destroy the bank that I've been passed. The assumption is you're going to pass me a bank that's already unique to the creation of this process. And the mechanism of recovery if something goes wrong is I'm going to whack the bank. There tend to be a lot of banks in the world, namely one per process. You could not do this right. You could fail to create a new bank, and I could whack this bank, and lo and behold, everything else you've ever allocated from it will go too. The contract is, if you don't hand me a unique bank, you said that was okay. So at some point, the set state thing. So set state is a sleazy trick. It shouldn't be here. It exists solely to avoid having architecture-dependent code in the constructor. So here's what we're actually trying to do. What we want to do here, A, we want to set the process running. That we can do, no problems, right? B, we want to set the initial program counter for this process. Now this raises the problem, the program counter is stored where? So, actually, it's not really a problem here because we can obviously implement a kernel set PC method. That could at least reduce the problem to how many bits long is the PC. But that, you know, that we could do. I mean, it's 64 bits, and it'll be good forever, at least until 128-bit machines show up. It could be next year. I've been making that mistake all the way through the history of computing. The problem was we really wanted to keep architecture dependencies out of make image. So, frankly, not for this use case, but for the make image use case, we invented this kludge. The kludge is start fault. Start fault is a special exception. All
binary process comes into the world running, suffering from this exception. And the kernel handles this exception internally. It's never delivered to your process handler. And the way it handles this exception is by taking the fault info value, which is your starting program counter, and copying it to your PC. Because the kernel already has to be architecture dependent. And the fault info field is architecture neutral. This is just a sleazy mechanism for not having to teach makeImage about register sets. I didn't want to do the work. Arrow's version of makeImage does know all of that, and it's got all manner of bugs related to updating. All right, so constructor is using the same mechanism. I'm not actually convinced that's a good idea, but there's nothing really wrong with it. So what's going to happen, right? We're going to set this thing running. It's going to immediately incur a startup fault. The kernel's going to say, oh, it's faulted. Let me deal with the fault. And it'll say, oh, this is a startup fault. I know how to deal with that. I'll copy the PC to the right place, clear the fault, resume the process. As I said, somewhere down at the bottom where the induction starts, things get icky. Okay. Now we're going to set up the endpoints. Both of these endpoints, right, I said the one that I hear on and the one that I speak on. This was completely wrong. There's one that I hear incoming requests on, and there's one that I'm going to get replies on. So what I really need to do is to shoot myself through both ears. Both of those point at me, so I'm going to set up their recipients to point at me. On the reply endpoint, I want to set the payload matching feature because that's going to guarantee that I don't get multiple replies. I'm then going to put them in well-known slots of this new process. So the subset of the CR_app registers, and hey, they're yours to mess with. But at the time you come into the world, there are a couple of things stashed there that you might want to arrange to hang on to first. Among them are the endpoint capability to your request endpoint, and the endpoint capability to your reply endpoint. We will continue in this vein playing games. Oh, let's see, what else are we going to do? We're going to put them in your capability register. Oh, we're going to set up your schedule slot, right? That came from the caller. We're going to set up your address space slot. A little counterintuitively, you don't actually run your address space yet. You're going to run this protospace thing. It's going to go and fabricate your address space. We're going to initialize a few other registers with arguments that came in. We're then going to put in place stuff that protospace needs. And protospace is going to need, what does it need here? It needs, well, protospace needs to know what your address space is. And it needs to know what your fault handler is, because it's going to go and set that up. So what's going on here is, look, if it was just your address space, or if it was just your fault handler, we wouldn't need protospace. What we want is a way to say, your fault handler, what I want you to do is run a new copy of the program that is created by that their constructor. It's going to create a new fault handler just for you. Don't you feel special? Somebody has to invoke that constructor. What's going to happen when we invoke that constructor? It's going to create a program. I don't know what it is. Somebody thought it was a handler, but I don't know that. I fabricate that program, set that program in motion, and if I'm really lucky and that program is really happy with me, it's going to reply. If it fails to reply to the constructor here, which is who's calling it, who would be calling it in the absence of protospace, this constructor will stay blocked forever. We don't want that. What we do instead is we contrive for your newly created program to fabricate its own handler on its own dime. We're going to go on and do something else. And some of the reasons that might fail, you know, your handler might not be well designed. But another reason it might fail is the guy who's asking for this thing to be created might not handle enough space. So we got to get out of the way. We got to get that construction to happen. We got to get your process in motion. The best way to do it is to make your process do the work to instantiate itself. And since we're fabricating your process, we do this sleazy trick of saying, oh, well, before we run your program, we're going to run our program on your dime. Okay. So what's going on here is we're providing the arguments that the protospace is going to call in this tricky way. Protospace, by the way, is a single page program written in the world's second ugliest assembler code. And the reason it's an assembly language program is because it has to run in an address space that simply does not permit any mutation at all. This is a purely read-only address space. You only get to modify registers. As we all know, the Pentium has a large number of registers. I'd imagine that program's a little delicate.
Delicate doesn't begin to describe it. Writing that was not fun. Of course, I wrote it, and then Jonathan Adams fixed it, so thankfully we have him. Okay. And then, now we've set the process in motion. Oh, the other thing we've provided, that we've provided with a reply capability to the party who originally asked us to build this thing. Notice we don't reply to that party. We reply to another. You, the requester, still haven't gotten an answer, but your process is running. And we're now ready to deal with the next requester. For the reply create call at the end of your initialize routine, this is what that's about. So the sequence here is going to be that we have a requester, we have a constructor, and we have a yield. And the flow of messages is that this guy says, build me one of those. And this guy, actually, there is no real message because it's done by setting up initial process state. But this guy says, go and run. And oh, by the way, here's the reply argument. The reply argument, right, pointed back to this guy, gets transferred by the constructor into the new process state. It's the new process that executes the reply. And that's what that reply constructor macro was doing, is this message. This, by the way, in the current code, this is the only place where something that looks like a procedure call is actually cracked open internally into its two constituent parts. Offhand, I can't think of another case in any object that's actually been implemented that does this. But in this case, you got to. All right, so that's it, right? That's how you get a running process. Somewhere in here, we set the darn thing running. Let's see if I can figure out where. Oh, yeah, right. After we populated all of its registers, we said resume that process, right? That has the effect of setting it running. If we were doing this in Unix system, right, we would have called fork and exec, and all of this GORP would have been done inside the kernel. So the good news about this style of design is you've got complete control of what goes everywhere. The bad news is you've got complete responsibility for what goes everywhere. As you've all seen, right, if you misuse that responsibility, the system will happily help you. Of course, that's why we build utility programs, right? This protocol is a pain in the butt. Really good to have one piece of code that does it so that you don't have to. But we get these other guarantees by virtue of being able to vet the capabilities that go into the new process. So, questions about constructor? I would like to do space bank, but I'm not actually that brave. Oh, no. Space bank is a serious hairball. Space bank has to keep a data structure for every single object in the system. Because for every single object in the system, it has to remember which bank it currently goes with. Because when you whack that bank, so A, when you go to destroy the object, it's got to be able to know, it's got to check, oh, you're destroying the object, but are you attempting to destroy it on my bank or on somebody else's bank? Like, you can't just take a random object and hand it to a random bank and try to destroy it. That shouldn't work, right? But the really fun part is if you whack the bank, this bank has to be able to enumerate all of the member objects of the bank. The I want to whack an object case is not so bad, right? It's one back pointer per object, not so bad. I want to whack a bank, the problem is now I need to know the set. Somebody had to keep track of that. And the way Space Bank does that is it keeps data structure per object. And hanging off of its bank structure, there's a list. So if you whack individual objects, you have to be able to take them off the list. Right? So there's just a yicky data structure. That's not so bad for the version of Space Bank that's currently in the tree, because the version of Space Bank currently in the tree is designed for use in embedded systems. But unfortunately, the data structure required to keep track of these objects has greater than zero size. You might be surprised that when you keep information, you need more than zero bits. Quantum entanglement aside, we've yet to get quantum entanglement out of C code. You know, if you figure it out, let me know. What you do is you entangle the bank and the object. It takes a minimum of four 32-bit words. Two for the pointers, and two more to hold the object ID, because that's a 64-bit quantity.
Actually, that would not be enough if you really had a large number of objects, because you might really have more than 2 to the 32 objects on a 750 gigabyte disk. That's more than is a little bit plausible. What's the price of a 750 gig drive now? I mean, why would you buy anything less? Well, you know, when we started working on the system, right, 10 gigabytes was a really big, expensive drive. And I said, people are going to have laptops with a terabyte of disk on it. And people at conferences basically looked at me and very politely said, not so far and not so long from now, my laptop will have that much storage. Right? Not that big a jump from a 200 gig drive to a terabyte drive. Your laptop has 250, and it only came out 4 months later. So it's a problem, right? I need to carry around 4 words per object, and I have more than 4 giga objects. So how do I fit those into the address space of SpaceBank on a 32-bit machine? Maybe you're shaking your head. Are you shaking your head because you're kind of enjoying the disgusting quality of the problem, or because you're just generally disgusted with the question, or because the answer is, if it hurts me to do this, don't do this again? So this is the point where you say, look, dummy, that's why AMD invented those other bits in the address. Okay, maybe they didn't invent them, but yeah. Yes, well, okay, I could, you know, you could go to a 64-bit implementation, and, you know, frankly, I'm in favor of that, because, among other things, the memory management in those systems is rather simpler. But there's this problem, right, that there are devices like these things, right? And AMD may have invented a few more bits, but nobody told ARM about that. ARM may figure it out because they're not total weasels, but Motorola is never going to get it. And they make a 64-bit processor. Right? But they're never going to take those bits off of the PowerPC and implement them on the 68,000 line. And the 68,000 line is the embedded processor market. There are 64-bit MIPS parts, right? But those extra bits chew up memory. Memory is actually still considered expensive. You may have noticed you can't actually buy an embedded machine with less than 128 megabytes of memory, right? But embedded software designers still think they have 4 kilobytes. So there's an expense to using more pointers, but just to really make this fun, some dingbat will use the USB port on this thing to wire up a 750 gigabyte drive expected to do something rational. It's not immediately clear to me what exactly that would be. Well, the Alice version of the SpaceBank manages that data structure as an out-of-memory data structure. It actually has a much larger space, right? Because the GPT structure does allow 64 bits, even if the hardware structure does not. It will not so gleefully map windows onto these objects in order to do the data structure traversal. It doesn't use pointers, it uses indexes. But this is not so happy-making, partly because, when you have to walk a tree structure and every traversal of the tree structure requires that you will rearrange your address space mapping, you might imagine that there was some overhead to that. So that bank implementation actually goes to great lengths to do extent-based allocation. Internally, it doesn't allocate one object at a time to a bank, right? It allocates a sequential chunk. And there are a variety of reasons why it's really good to do that if you can get away with it. And this has the effect that it reduces the per object overhead because you can aggregate the management structures. It doesn't always work, but it's never worse than the real thing. And it often gets you a factor of 32 or so advantage, which won't help you with the next generation of Seagate drives, but it's good enough for the 750s. And the other thing to observe is that, you know, aside from a few people over in, you know, DNA sequencing, here's a tidbit. I had a wonderful conversation with Peter Capek several years ago at IBM. And IBM got the clever idea that, or rather, Peter got the clever idea, and it was a clever idea, that, you know, when people bought a new machine, they don't want to migrate their old stuff, right? And we were toying with what would it take to do that. Of course, you know, IBM was always slightly behind the times, because you could already get that software at CompUSA. But, you know, one of the questions is, so, okay, if I got to migrate stuff, how much of the old disk is used at the time that the user retires the machine? The answer then, and disks were not very big, was under 20%. And of that 20%, 98% of it was Windows. So the amount of actual content on the drive is small. So this is one of these interesting cases where there's interesting pressures, right? You've got to design a space bank that's actually going to work. And in order to work, it's got to use data structures that are potentially inconvenient and inefficient. But in the real world scenarios, it somehow has to dodge the bullet on those inefficiencies. And this is sort of a real world design problem. And of course, of all of the pieces of code in the system that you could want to make complicated, the primordial storage allocator would certainly be your first choice of things you want to complicate, right? Okay.
All of this is a long-winded excuse for why I'm not going to try to walk through space bank. But what else do we want to look at? Is there anything else here even worth looking at? Yeah.
You mentioned you wanted to go back to disables.
No, I think I actually did do what I wanted to do.
Okay.
Virtual copy space may be worth a quick look. Process handler is a placeholder that is in my tree and nobody else's. Most of this, once again, is boilerplate. Okay, so fault, right? We took an address space fault. The model of virtual copy space is, look, if you take a fault, our job is to grow the space and populate it so that your reference will now succeed. To do that, we're going to try to buy some more storage. Well, that comment is moderately worrisome. Oh, I see what's going on. Okay. There's some interesting problem here. We're going to walk down a tree. At some point, we're going to get to a null capability that occupies the slot that we now need to populate. But we don't know how far down that is. And when we find it, we're still going to need to have the capability to the GPT that contains that slot. So part of what that means is we can't just perform the traversal by saying, oh, I hold the capability of the GPT, I'm not in terrible danger yet, so let me just load the next capability down into the same capability. Because at some point I will step off the cliff and then I need to step back. And if I don't still have the parent capability, I can't step back, so I can't be clobbering it as I go. This code apparently uses three capabilities, and I'm not actually clear why it should do that. In the Eros case, what happened was you used two capabilities, and you would just alternate them, which one was the parent and which one was the child. Okay. And this is one of these cases where because the capability isn't actually a value, it's really a location for value, you have to ping-pong them. So it's a little strange. What ends up happening is what you end up doing is you allocate two registers for this, right? But register 4 is either the next pointer or the parent pointer. Then when it becomes the next pointer, register 3 becomes the parent pointer. Very sort of peculiar, weird algorithm going on here. And it's not that it's conceptually difficult. You're just trying to keep the parent pointer and the child pointer, but you're doing it at one level in direction because you're doing this with capabilities, ability locations. So the first part of the algorithm actually isn't that bad, okay? Which is, it could be, most likely actually, that, at least in the early faults, that the reason the fault occurred was that the space wasn't big enough. And if the space is not yet big enough and we want to populate it, first step is going to be to grow. I know why he needs three capabilities. But let me not go back to that just yet. So basically, if the space we're looking at, we're going to try to get its L2V, which tells us what the slot size is for the top element of the current space. And it's too low, then the space is malformed, and we need to do something about that someday. What he means here is if it's illegally too low. And this does not work the way I thought at all. Aha, apparently he threw my old design overboard, which is perfectly fine, but it's going to leave me at a slight disadvantage. Okay, well, there's probably a perfectly fine reason why this doesn't work, but let me tell you what's going to go on in principle. Oh, I see what he did. Okay. So if the existing space is simply not large enough, then we have to grow. What we're going to do, there's an interesting problem now, which is, with nodes, you couldn't usefully skip any levels. So there was no real question in that case what you were going to do, right? You were simply going to grow the space up until it was big enough. So basically, you had a tree, it was of some size, it consists of nodes internally, and you start tacking nodes on it up at the top,
because whatever the existing tree is has to be preserved. And then at some point, you're then going to start populating down along the path of the fall. So you can put a page somewhere. For GPT, the answer is a little more complicated than this. The reason the answer is a little more complicated than this is that we have the guard field. The guard field allows us to leave out those nodes in the middle. So we still have to grow the tree, but we can't grow the tree naively. If you were to look at the Eros version of this code, right, you would see that the first part was a loop that said, while the tree isn't tall enough, stick a new node in and put the old tree in slot 0 of the new tree. Now that you have a tall enough tree, do the naive downward traversal. You still have to worry about the capability ping pong, but you only need two capabilities necessary. That's the first version. Then Larry McVoy helped me by writing LNBench. LNBench is a really good way to measure things that you really actually shouldn't care about, but you need to in order to publish things in SOSP. And Larry taught me that naive algorithms are called naive for a reason, and that what you should do is cheat. You should take advantage of the fact that if you did a fault on a page a minute ago, you're probably going to fault on the adjacent page next. Notice that if you fault on the adjacent page next, you're about to do the same walk that you did before. And with a very, very small, disgusting hack, I arranged for the process to simply remember, where did I walk last time? And it's still got the parent capability for that dangling around. And it said, oh, well, if I walked through the same bottom level node last time, I can skip the walk this time because the answer hasn't changed. And that got a factor of 16 reduction, and that was enough to make things fast. Factor of 32 reduction. All right. In this case, you can't quite do that because you're trying not to do the growth naively. The reason you don't want to do the growth naively is each of these nodes, it's not the storage cost, although that's part of it, but later the kernel's going to go lock these darn things to try to build you a page table, and the more levels there are, the longer it's going to take. So if the space is too small, the algorithm is going to grow the tree, but it's going to have skipped levels in doing so. And then when it decides to go down the tree, it's got to consider guard values and say, well, I'm looking at the guard value, I have a new address I have to go through. Now, there are two possibilities. One, the existing guard value is a prefix of the address, then I'm okay and I just go to the next level. The existing guard value and the new address are somehow in conflict, in which case what I have to do is make a cut in the guard at the right place so that I can insert a GPT. And the algorithm has to deal with it. That insert a GPT in the middle case never arose in the old algorithm with nodes. That's why he needs three capabilities to traverse when the old thing needed two. I haven't read it, and I've, of course, just realized that I haven't read it. So I'm not going to try to walk through the loop in depth. This took John at least a week to think out. Not a straightforward algorithm. That's not right. The algorithm is straightforward, but determining that the straightforward algorithm was, in fact, the right algorithm to use was not straightforward. And Scott actually put a lot of help into that by pointing out that, so you're tempted to say, oh, well, I should attempt somehow to cleverly optimize my guard values, you know, so that I don't introduce any extra levels where I can avoid it. It turns out that there are collateral costs to doing that if you're not careful. So it turns out that if we were to say, look, the guard values, right, they're always quantized at a multiple of 2 to 4 pages. So 2 to the 4, or 2 to the 8, or 2 to the 0, but not the other values in the middle. Why 2 to the 4? Because 16 slots, right? It turns out you want the LTB values of your GPTs to be at certain natural alignment boundaries, because if they're not, they force you to introduce new GPTs to realign things later. This was one of these arguments that took like 2 months to go back and forth before it converged. And it has nothing to do with what you can do with the data structure in principle. It has to do with observed behavior on real address spaces. Algebraically, it's much simpler if you just allow the full expressiveness on the guard offset. A little hand-wavy, I know, I apologize. Questions about this? Unless there are objections, next week I'd like to use part of the time to talk about what's good about Linux. Contrary to the impression you may have formed, that will take us more than a minute. Even more than 2. But my list of what things are good about Unix is a little different from Dennis's. And I'm not saying Dennis's list is invalid. In fact, I think it's a really good list. Dennis was once asked, you know, what would you change if you could go back into Unix over again? And he said, I wouldn't have taken the E off of the creat operation. But also, what are the weak spots? And under the sort of more, slightly more general view of Unix, I'm going to include some things about Plan 9 in that story, okay, which is a really interesting system. And I then want to do the same thing about capability systems, what's good and what's bad about them, or downsides. And it's worth talking about what they are. I will be happy to answer any questions about, you know, project or assignment or anything like that. We'll take our obligatory 5 minutes to fill in the course review, and the next professor will deal with the consequences. So, does that seem like a reasonable use of time for next week? All right. Thank you.